Welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm talking with Kelly Cope. She's USU's Extension Water Conservation and Turfgrass Specialist. And Kelly, coming up for this summer, it's going to be a rude awakening for people.
I think so.
There's just not enough water to go around. And you've been trying to spread the word for years.
Yes.
But I think sometimes for some, until it smacks them upside the head, it just doesn't really have the impact.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think there are a few things coming into play this summer that haven't been on people's minds as much perhaps in the past. One of those things is the drought in California, frankly. And the amount of coverage that that's getting in the news has really got people paying attention and looking at basically less than zero snowpacks over there and incredible reductions in use for agriculture as well as municipal use. And, you know, the entire state basically being restricted for the first time in history. And so that is a hot topic right now in the news, and we're not so far away from California, so people are seeing that.
Well, and when you talk about, is it Beverly Hills has to reduce their water by like 38% or something?
Yes, and they have actually gone through the state community by community, and those that seem more, you know, that are using more water are being required and asked to save even more water. Those that are more efficient are also being asked to save more water, but not quite to the same degree. So they're trying to be equitable, although I suspect if you were to ask the various communities, they would not think the process is that equitable. But, you know, again, all of that is coming into play, I think, here in our state this year. But we, of course, have our own water issues, and we have had our own water issues for a number of years. And so I think the two things are working together to really get people's attention, along with community restrictions that are already being put in place in the state of Utah this year.
So in California, are you seeing pricing changes? And will that eventually happen in Utah? Because it seems like people won't make the change unless they have some incentive to do so.
Right. And I think, you know, those of us who work in water efficiency look at the bigger picture. You know, what are the things that need to be put in place to encourage conservation and water use efficiency? Certainly water rates are part of that. But as you may know, the changing of water rates becomes a fairly political matter very, very quickly. And so it's sometimes politically untenable, even though it is often the right thing to do to get folks' attention and to more accurately reflect the cost of delivering, treating, and supplying that water. It's politically difficult.
Why? I mean, because if you have that incentive of, okay, if you use more, you pay more, why is that politically an issue?
The issue is that whenever, let's just take a city council, some random city council, and they are considering a rate change. Whenever there is a change in rates to, in this case, water or whatever it may be, there is a great deal of public outcry against that. And it is true that there should be due process and work done, due diligence, to make sure that those changes are appropriate, but there is just a blanket outcry against it typically.
What's the outcry?
The outcry is that I don't want to pay any more money, period. Despite the fact that what you are paying may not reflect the true cost. And so I see in political situations, elected officials facing that kind of outcry, and it's hard, and it is very difficult, and it takes someone with very strong resolution to say, I know it's hard, but it's correct, and we need to do it, and I am going to risk my political position to make it happen. I have seen it done, and those are incredibly courageous folks who I commend, but they are not the norm. It is very politically difficult.
And so then usually they just kind of cave? I mean, it's going to get to a point where it's like, sorry, this is the way that it is.
And it is going
they,
to get,
they can't cave in.
It is going to get to that point. And on the positive side of that, I guess I would say if there is a positive side to that, the more it happens, the more desperate the situation becomes, the more communities that do go that route, the easier it will be for other communities to go that route.
Because then their constituents will say, well, neighboring communities are doing
exactly.
it. So it's just
exactly
ultimately going to happen.
You know, and the good news, the really good news I can share with you about that, if we want to talk a little more about water rates, is that there is precedent, especially in the United States, for financing water in a very sustainable way so that water utilities and water suppliers can cover their basic costs and people and yet still provide opportunities and incentives for conservation. So there's a lot of new research and work being done in that area.
So given the changes that are they have to happen, you run out of water mm-hmm. if you don't make the changes.
Mm-hmm.
What restrictions are you seeing in place in many cities here in the state?
Well, the first ones that I've heard about so far this year have to do with landscape irrigation, which, of course, is the area that I am most concerned with, the area that I work on and do research in. And so there are restrictions being put in place, such as day of the week restrictions. You can only irrigate 2 days per week or 3 days per week, things like that. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about the usefulness of that kind of restriction, because that doesn't really address the time that mm-hmm. that irrigation is occurring for and the actual volume of irrigation. But, you know, it's something that communities are doing partly to address peak demand. And so peak demand is that time in the water system of a community when the water use is at its highest. And so by distributing that water use and by saying, okay, this area of the community only use water on these 2 days, this area of the community only use water on these 2 other days, it helps to reduce that peak demand, which is a huge concern for a lot of cities and water suppliers.
Do you see more of use of water sensors, moisture sensors, so that systems aren't going off when they
yes.
don't need to be?
Yes. I mean, one thing that I would say I'm encouraged by is the increased use of some of the really terrific irrigation technologies that we have available.
And right here in Cache Valley, there's some great technology that's been developed.
Absolutely. So things like you mentioned, soil moisture sensors that can be attached to irrigation controllers and only allow irrigation when the soil moisture depletes to a certain level. Climate-based irrigation controllers that actually receive a weather-based signal and allow irrigation or do not allow irrigation. Extremely efficient sprinkler nozzles. I mean, there are a number of things, products, technologies available to help people have a quality landscape that functions in the way they want it to, but reduce their water use to a much more efficient level.
When I drive home, sometimes I'll work late, and when I'm driving home, it's just really irritating to see that it's raining outside or it's been cold or whatever, and yet there's a church that doesn't turn their water off.
Yeah.
And it's going. It's just going, and sometimes it's raining, and their sprinkler system is going. That's
right.
The kind of stuff that I see, that it's so easy to change.
It is.
And we're not quite getting, I guess we're now getting to that point where it's going to have to.
Well, it is going to have to. And, you know, to be fair to those folks, they're working with an irrigation controller that is set. It's got a set schedule, and there's nobody on site at that moment when it's raining to turn it off. What they could do, and what all of us could do, is simply attach a rain sensor to our irrigation controllers. And this is something that you put outside somewhere in your landscape that is exposed to rainfall. And when it gets enough rainfall, it cuts the irrigation off through your controller. So it addresses exactly the scenario you're talking about.
Or you could just be a hose dragger like myself. I don't.
Yes.
Are you still a hose dragger?
I am I would say a halfway hose dragger. Okay. I've got still dragging a hose around my backyard, but automatic irrigation in my front yard. But even with the automatic irrigation in my front yard, I still control that somewhat manually. I don't just turn it on. In fact, I turn it off. It's off. And then when I'm looking at my landscape and it appears to need water, I go run it for one round and then I'm done. I turn it off again.
See, I think that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
Because then you're not assuming the system knows what's going on, because the system doesn't.
Well, the system only knows what you tell it.
Exactly.
And so if you are not adjusting it through the growing season to reflect conditions outside, you're not being as efficient as you could be. And that's something that's really challenging for folks. If you ask them to change their irrigation schedule on a monthly basis, many of them are challenged by that. So that's where, you know, things like climate-based controllers come in, because they make those changes without monthly, weekly input from the individual.
And you mentioned in a circular that you sent out recently that plants actually prefer having it dry out in between.
That's right.
I mean, if you've got plants that are especially adapted to this area,
mm-hmm.
Which is another topic, but they don't like to be wet all the time.
No,
it's okay,
I mean,
to dry out in between.
Absolutely. I mean, you can think of it this way. Plants, we have so much in common with plants. Let's look at it that way. We all need food, nutrition. In the case of plants, those are nutrients gained from the soil. We all need air. Plant roots need to breathe just like we do, and we all need water. Plants need to take water up through their roots just like we need to ingest water to survive. And so they require all those things just like we do. If the soil is continually wet, continually saturated, it doesn't allow those roots to get the air that they require. And it's not a healthy situation for those plants.
So to reduce the amount of water that's just evaporating, what period of time would you say this is when you need to water?
So I don't, I'm going to hedge myself a little bit here because of that peak demand issue that we were discussing earlier. But that aside, what I will say is that if you want to reduce evaporative losses of irrigation water, you're looking at irrigating sometime during the nighttime hours when there is no radiation coming in from the sun and less water loss due to evaporation. So that would be ideal if you can. You know, then in terms of plant health and reducing disease incidence and moisture on leaves, you're looking at somewhere closer to, you know, the very wee hours of the morning, 4 or 5, something like that.
And that's where having your system, if you have a system, can be helpful, because if you know, okay, I watched the weather before last night, so there's, it looks like it's going to be a hot day the next day. It's time to water. You can set the system to go for those couple of hours in the early morning, and then you're done.
Yes, you can do that. But okay. I would encourage folks to really get more friendly with your landscapes this summer and get an eye for when things are truly drying out. Because, you know, the challenge we face, and I think this is why it's been sort of a long sell. I mean, I've been in this position for 15 plus years at this point, saying the same exact sorts of things. But I think the issue that people have is that landscapes can take a lot of excessive water before they start showing damage. And that is the challenge. If landscape plant materials, turf grass, for example, immediately look terrible when they were overwatered, it would be another story entirely. So that's the challenge. They are able to take a lot of excessive water before they start showing detrimental effects. And it's our job to try to help folks find that happy medium. You know, efficient use of water, quality of landscape, everyone's happy.
And there are a number, and I mean, there are a lot of new turf grass varieties that are much better at utilizing water than some of the older ones.
That's absolutely true. And if I could get on a little bit of a soapbox for a minute, I am aware of some programs in the West that pay people to remove grass. And the idea there is that grass in the landscape is a higher water use plant, and if it's removed, then whatever replaces it will necessarily be lower water use. You and I both know that that is not necessarily the case, and that removing grass removes a lot of the functional benefits of grass in the landscape. So, for example, dust suppression, biofiltration, prevention of soil erosion, carbon sequestration. I mean, I could go on and on. Atmospheric cooling. It does a lot of great things in the landscape. Okay, having said that, we do have lots and lots of new varieties out there, as you just mentioned, that are much lower in water use. As an example, some work that I'm aware of from colleagues across the country has developed bluegrass varieties that use half the water of currently used species.
Wow.
Yes, I mean, it's stunning and it's wonderful. And so I guess my message that I'm really trying to get out, both within Utah and within the region, is that we can have it all in this case. We can have grasses in our landscapes that function in the way we want them to, that we can play on, recreate on, etc., but that use at least half the water of more traditionally used varieties. And I'm really excited because we're testing some of these experimental varieties here at USU right now. So, you know, turf grass scientists like myself, we have not had our heads buried in a hole for the past 50 years. We have been working on this topic, developing new varieties, working on how to manage them to be absolutely as efficient as we can be.
So these varieties are not yet available. They're still being tested?
Some of them are actually available. Okay. And if you'd like another website, there's...
Please do.
Okay. So there is a nonprofit organization called the Turf Grass Water Conservation Alliance, and their website is tgwca.org. And they have a lot of products listed there that have gone through an extremely rigorous testing process at universities around the country. It's a cooperative venture between seed companies and universities. And there's just some amazing stuff available out there now.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So what makes them so efficient? Are they just growing slower? Do they grow deeper roots?
You know,
all of the above?
There is something to each of the things you mentioned. The physiological reasons, that's something that more research should be done on. But the bottom line, the rubber meets the road with these grasses that can maintain green cover under less irrigation. Hmm. And that's what some of these grasses are doing. Like I said, 50%, up to 50% less water than typically used species.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
I'm going to be looking into it.
Well,
so the things that we've talked about for many times over the years, mowing height.
Mm-hmm. Mowing higher.
Mow it as high as you can or...
Yes.
I mean,
so
get over having this perfectly manicured look. I mean, it can look still really good.
I love the perfectly manicured look, but it doesn't have to be 1 inch high. You can have that perfectly manicured look if it's 4 inches high.
Get over the perfectly manicured golf course look.
Yes. Let's do that. Because typically, you know, home landscapes in particular, you don't need it to look like a golf course. And you still want to have the functionality, but you want to be efficient with water use. And so, yes, there's that relationship. The higher you mow the grass, the deeper the roots will grow. And so the deeper the roots grow, the more access to soil moisture they have, and the more healthy the plants will be.
And water less often, but deeper.
That's correct.
To 12 inches, mm-hmm. make sure the water gets down that far.
That's correct.
How do you know how far the water's gotten?
Well, there's a really simple thing you can do. You know, you can run your system for whatever the typical amount of time is that you usually do. And then you can simply take a screwdriver. And if you press the screwdriver into the ground and it goes very easily, you can see how far it moves, and that will tell you how far the water is moved. Because when the soil is dry, you're going to meet resistance.
Hmm.
You can also dig a hole. Why not dig a hole?
Ask your dog to dig a hole. Irrigate shady areas, of course, less often than sunny areas.
Yes. So you're describing the concepts behind hydrozoning, which is just irrigating areas appropriately for the plant material there, as well as the conditions like slope, aspect, shade, sun. By aspect, I'm talking about, is it south-facing, west-facing, things like that.
Covering bare soil in the garden and flower beds with 2 to 3 inches of mulch.
That is one of the absolute best things you can do to prevent evaporation from that soil surface. And not only that, but in terms of weeding, having that mulch in your flower beds is going to save you so much time. And weeds that do grow will come out much easier.
And it's also better for many of the vegetables. For instance, tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to dry out and then get wet and then dry out.
Right.
So if you keep that consistent moisture, you don't end up with the blossom end rot on the end of the tomato that you normally would.
Exactly. Mulching is something that I even consider with regard to turf grasses. And there, what I'm suggesting is that you return, recycle, or mulch the clippings back into the system when you mow, because that sort of serves the same purpose. Those clippings filter down, they cover bare soil areas, and not only that, they decompose and add organic matter to the turf and soil system, which then retains more moisture. So you're supporting the whole cycle when you return clippings, and you are retaining nutrients on the site. So, you know, I see a lot of companies out there mowing and going and blowing, and they're removing the clippings. And I hope that they're doing something good with them, because to me, they're a great resource. And so hopefully they're ending up in some compost or vegetable garden somewhere, something like that. I actually put off mowing and watering as long as I possibly can in the spring, because I'm trying to encourage those deep roots. And I'd encourage everybody to be doing that. That's just a really great way to start off the season. But then, yes, once you get into the routine of mowing, please do recycle those clippings, because they're a great resource. If you go on vacation and you come home and you're left with, you know, really high grass, that is not the time to return those clippings. That's the time to bag them and perhaps put them in the garden, as you mentioned, or compost them in some other way.
Anything else you would like to add at this point?
Well, I just would hope that people will be a little bit more hands-on with their landscapes this summer. And by that, I mean really having a look at things and not turning irrigation on until you see that there are dry spots, there are plants that are needing it. Because if people can do that through the course of this summer, that will really help with peak demand, and it will help with overall water use in the state. And of course, we know that conservation is the best way to maintain our water supplies. Mm-hmm. And so we would always encourage folks to be as efficient as they can with their water.
Great. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Kelly Cope is USU's Extension Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist, and we'll have her back in again, I'm sure.
Thanks, Brian.